You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
So, good morning. I'm Darrell West. Excuse me. It's a very emotional topic for me here today. I'm Vice President of Governance Studies and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. And I would like to welcome you to today's forum on strengthening civic participation and public engagement. Many of our laws today predate the internet era, and so it sometimes has been hard to get people engaged. Sometimes there are legal barriers to public engagement. So over the past year, the Working Group on Legal Frameworks for Public Participation has produced some new tools to help in this area. They have come up with a model local ordinance. They have amendments to state legislation. They have examples out on the table right outside the auditorium if you didn't get a chance to pick up their recommendations. But these tools are designed to create a more supportive and productive environment for public participation. So today we have a distinguished panel to discuss these new tools and ways to strengthen the legal framework for public participation. So I'd like to introduce the moderator for this session. Matt Leininger is the executive director of the Deliberative Democracy Consortium. He is a longtime advocate for ways to deepen deliberation and engage more people in the process of decision making. The consortium is an alliance of major organizations and leading scholars working in the fields of deliberation and public engagement. It represents more than 50 different foundations, nonprofit organizations, and universities collaborating to support research and to advance democratic practices. Over the last 16 years, Matt has worked with public engagement efforts in over 100 communities, 40 states, and four Canadian provinces. He lives in Canada, so hence the Canada interest. He is a senior associate for Everyday Democracy, and he serves on the boards of eDemocracy.org, the National School Public Relations Association, and the Democracy Imperative. He is the author of a terrific book entitled The Next Form of Democracy, How Expert Rule is Giving Way to Shared Governance, and Why Politics Will Never Be the Same. So please join me in welcoming Matt.
Thank you, Darrell, for hosting us and also for the work that you do here on governance and participation. There's a lot of things happening that people ought to be exploring a little bit further. Thanks also to Anna Goodbaum, who did a lot of the logistics for today and who has told me that there will, in fact, be an audio replay of this. So if people want to listen to it, that'll be available on the Brookings site. Also, thank you all for coming. I see a lot of familiar faces, people who've been part of this work for a long time, and I also see some new faces, so that's terrific as well. Where this all started was, actually it's unclear how it all started, but I guess I'd say that there's been, for a long time, among those of us who do public participation work, this general sense that the laws on public participation were occasionally a hindrance and almost never a help. That essentially, either because they mandate outdated formats that we know don't work very well, like your typical 3 minutes on a microphone public hearing, or because they seem to discourage more constructive forms of dialogue, or because they're simply unclear about what constitutes a public meeting, what constitutes a decision, all those kinds of things. And this lack of clarity in particular relating to the newer types of online engagement, that for all those reasons, the laws really were more of occasionally a hindrance and almost never a help. This was, as I say, kind of a long, kind of simmering kind of a question for us. I think what triggered this particular effort, though, was the fact that a couple of years ago, the American Bar Association passed a resolution on civil discourse, which basically required ABA members and the association as a whole to take up this question of strengthening civil discourse, not just as a matter of behavior, but as a matter of law. And so that was kind of an excuse for a number of us to really get together and look at this more closely. And Bruce Meyerson, who was the chair of the task force on civil discourse for the ABA, was one of the kind of leaders of our group from the very beginning. Along the way, we kind of picked up other people from other associations who have an interest in this issue, National League of Cities, the International City County Management Association, the International Municipal Lawyers Association, which is the city attorneys group, And then also groups like the Policy Consensus Initiative and the International Association for Public Participation, the National Civic League, and then also the National Coalition for Dialogue and Deliberation. And the Civic League is the publisher and producer of the document that we're releasing today. And the NCDD, Sandy Heuerbacher, has been very helpful as far as creating, helping to produce that document. And Sandy, I think, coined the title, so we have to thank her for that. So the handout, as I think everyone probably knows, has been tweeted and emailed to death, but the full document is available at the DDC website, and the handouts that you were able to pick up at the beginning outside the room there are of the 3 minutes on a microphone rationale piece and the model ordinance itself. I want to also say that everybody who's worked on this, and there's a total of at least 50 or so people, has done so as a volunteer. And in fact, even more than that, some of the people I know on those occasions when we met face-to-face actually paid their way to do it. So this comes out of a lot of commitment from people who are passionate about this issue from a bunch of different angles. And that mix of different angles has also been, I think, very helpful. We've had from the beginning, you know, conversations that were lively because they had fierce legal scholars and loquacious lawyers and curmudgeonly public officials and devastatingly brilliant participation practitioners. And it was always good because we had that mix of people who wanted to require everything and people who wanted to require nothing, and all these different kinds of important questions which went into this were kind of, you know, hashed out in these conversations. So that's really helpful. What we've ended up with, as I think you can see here, is a model which we assume cities will adapt as they will, but a model that does not require public participation of any particular format, but enables and supports what we hope will be better public participation, partly because it includes the principles that in the field have emerged through IEP2, through NCDD, through Terry Amsler, through many different people who have written about this, the principles for productive public participation. One other thing, that this template has already actually been used. So the city of Oakland earlier this year used this model ordinance, again, adapting it to create their budget transparency and public participation policy. So we've already got a neat kind of victory there as far as somebody who's actually found this to be useful. So let me turn it to our panelists here to say a little bit more about this. And you have more extensive bios in the handout, the program here, so I'm not going to say too much about each of these people. Lisa Amsler has been a leading scholar in this field for years and years, and a friend to practitioners and all kinds of people who are doing this kind of work, and has written many, many things that you can see about the kind of the legal framework in addition to other aspects of public participation. Mike Huggins was perhaps the most innovative public manager in terms of public participation for years and years in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and is now...
He was the only one.
He was the only one. it is now affiliated with ICMA, Center for Management Strategies, and the National Civic League. And then Kevin Curry from Code for America leads up Brigade, which is... Code for America is a very interesting and dynamic organization that's helping cities all over the country do new things as far as online engagement. And Brigade, in particular, is a kind of expansion of their earlier efforts that allows many more cities to be part of that work. So I'll start, though, with Lisa, because Lisa has been the main drafter of all of our legal language and had to persevere through many difficult conversations, very long conference calls, and one near-death experience, and has made it this far. So take it away.
Thank you, and it's wonderful to be here, and I'm going to keep this short. First of all, what's the problem? How did we get here, and what can we do about it? And the problem is that the default public participation model is 3 minutes at a microphone, with people falling asleep on the podium, unable to respond, people at the microphone unable to say what they really want to say because they're limited to 2 or 3 minutes, and no interaction among any of the people in the room. That's the default. The problems that we have seem to include things like no discussion outside the scope of the agenda, which means if somebody gets a good idea that isn't encompassed by what's been published as the official notice of the meeting, in Arizona, if whoever is watching over, the staff members watching over the meeting, if they let them go there and it's not on the agenda, then an elected official can actually be removed from office because of provisions in the government and the Sunshine Law. We have problems in rulemaking at the federal level where you can't have a big several thousand person dialogue like America Speaks would sponsor, because you can't capture all the comments people are making to each other at tables of 8 to 10 for the rulemaking record, right? We have problems where we've got organized disruption at the local government level because of concerns about Agenda 21, for example. And so we had a session at the International Municipal Lawyers Association about these drafts, and the municipal lawyers raised the problem that we've got 50 different states, different versions of the Sunshine Laws, different versions of Freedom of Information Laws, all bringing their strengths and weaknesses, but creating a problem where in-house lawyers don't have cover when they want to authorize innovation in public engagement and more dialogic or deliberative processes. So that's the basic problem. How we got here is partly a function of the history of administrative law at the federal and state levels. The federal models are adapted by the various states. So, you know, you start back in the New Deal, and the sick chicken case for those lawyers in the audience, Schechter Poultry, which was this private writing of industrial codes that the public didn't get access to and couldn't find and weren't published. That gives us the Administrative Procedure Act in 1946. And there's the birth of public participation as a legal right, but it's just notice and comment, and it's not defined. And there are iterations. You know, we then have the Freedom of Information Act, the Government and Sunshine Act. We have transparency, but again, that doesn't give us more participation necessarily. We then have dispute resolution, the Administrative Dispute Resolution Act, which gives us more dialogic processes, but it's aimed more downstream in policy enforcement, as opposed to where the space we're talking about, which is upstream in the idea of identifying problems, identifying potential solutions, making policy, implementing policy. And so the state models, Administrative Procedure Acts, Freedom of Information Act, Sunshine Acts, followed the federal, but they diverged. We've got tremendous variation. So in the U.S. Code, more than 200 uses of public participation, not defined, is defined in some regulations. California, more than 300 uses, generally not defined in the code. Home rule acts for municipalities that give them the power to do more autonomy in terms of ordinance making at the local government level. The Home Rule Acts generally are silent on public participation. So there's where we are. That's how we got here. We've got a gap. We don't have supportive legal infrastructure for what we now know we need to do. So the gaps in authority, public participation isn't defined. We don't have broad-based authority or any kind of a mandate for deliberative democracy, participatory democracy, other forms of public engagement. And the perception that government and the Sunshine Laws can actually be a constraint. What we have come up with as a first step to empower, focused at the local government level and to some extent state agency level, to empower more creative thinking in dialogue between public officials and the public, is to propose ultimately three, but I'll leave that to Mike. Two constructs, a public participation act at the state level, and we could do the same thing at the federal level, but that's not what we're here to talk about, and a municipal ordinance so that we set the ground for whoever wants to innovate, we make it more possible for them to do so. The structure of the Public Participation Act is drawn in large part from the very successful Federal Administrative Dispute Resolution Act of 1996. A little bit of history is worthwhile here. In the 1980s, EPA was experimenting like mad with dispute resolution, various forms of mediation, facilitation, negotiated rulemaking. So was the Army Corps of Engineers. The Department of Education, in the meanwhile, was saying, we can't do that. We can't do mediation. We don't have authority to do so. And so you had this collision which resulted in a bipartisan agreement in Congress. Remember those? amazing. Different reasons, the same conclusion, that we needed a statute to authorize public federal agencies to do this stuff, not to mandate it, just to let them. And the thousand flowers bloomed. So all the statute did was it defined the processes that you can use any form of administrative dispute resolution, mediation, facilitation, fact-finding, all these different things. You can look inside, write a policy on when and how you're going to use them. In fact, you need to write a policy. And appoint somebody inside to be your dispute resolution specialist. So we've taken those three elements, and we've defined public participation. And the sneaky thing is, the idea is if we define it here to include all those things we want to do, deliberative democracy, consensus building, policy dialogues, the National Issues Forum, What America Speaks does with the 21st Century Town Meeting, if we include all these things in the definition, then the definition will attach to every use of public participation throughout the code. And then we've opened the door. Then the idea is, let's define the policy process we're talking about. We're including way upstream so that it's clear we want to start at the beginning when people are identifying the policy problem. Then we also include a public participation specialist. So appoint somebody already on staff, collateral duty assignment, no budget implications. Just somebody needs to go get educated. They then, in Yoda fashion, pass on what they have learned, right? The pyramid structure. They come home to the agency, they train everybody else, their trainees train everybody else. So we disseminate knowledge about public engagement because a lot of the folks, I mean, I teach in a public affairs school, right? We don't require that our students learn this stuff. It's not a mandatory part of our curriculum. I would like it to be, obviously, but I'm not in the majority yet. So we have the public participation specialists, and then we protect the agencies from lawsuits. So let them experiment and innovate, but commit the decision on process to agency discretion so that they can innovate without somebody saying, you can't do this. As long as they meet the minimum mandatory public participation, like notice and comment, that's already in the statute.
Move the mic like down 2 inches.
Oh, can you not hear me?
No, it's just that your hair is what's causing.
Sorry. all right. So I'll stop moving around so much.
That's right. Stop being so passionate about this.
The last, it's hard. You know, it makes me crazy. So the last piece of the statute is just the beginning of trying to get at the Government and the Sunshine and Freedom of Information Acts. We know the world has changed since 1966 when those statutes were written, right? Nobody's done much with them since. So all we do is propose a public participation meeting where you actually have in the Government of the Sunshine Act a provision allowing elected officials to meet with the public with a very general, very open agenda announcement that allows for innovative thinking and creativity and let them actually interact and discuss with each other without taking action, without a vote, but to allow public officials to engage directly with the public, which in some states is actually problematic if you have a quorum there at the meeting. And the limitations would be once we've had general agenda, public meeting, interactive process, then the results get published or the thing gets live streamed for enough period of time that anyone who wasn't there can find out about it before there's then a notice of a public meeting at which action might be taken. But once that period of time has elapsed, the created information from interacting with the public could actually be used by elected officials, is the basic concept. Where am I in my 12 minutes?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay.
You only got one slide left, I think.
Okay. So in addition to the using the same basic concept and models, we then propose a model ordinance. And just as the Public Act does, it defines public participation. It defines the policy process in which people could engage. It suggests that there be a policy adopted by the local government. It suggests that local government appoint someone in-house as a public engagement or public participation, since that's the more common term of art used in this arena, a public participation specialist. And then it incorporates these principles that we know are principles for best practice in deliberative democracy, participatory democracy, public engagement. And they are principles that relate to inclusion, to involving people in the design of the process, to transparency, to accessibility, and to communication, so that people don't just participate in a meeting and then never hear anything again about how their information and their input is used. And Mike will talk more about other elements of a public participation ordinance. There's also a model policy in the materials online and that Matt has drafted and that incorporates information from lots of folks. And I think with that, I will stop.
Great. Actually, could I just make a quick plug for participation among the group here? If we're using participation law on Twitter as the hashtag. So if you're in front of your computer and your smartphone and you have a comment or a thought, participation law is your hashtag.
Thank you.
Please participate.
Go ahead, Mike.
Just a couple general comments. It's very, from a local government perspective, it's very important to understand the connection from having a state statute that allows local governments to take actions, as well as the what the model ordinance, what the ordinance would be at the local level. And there's a lot of variation among the states. So from a local government perspective, many cases we're tied to what is allowed in the state enabling statutes. Also, as proof of the innovation as manager, we allowed 5 minutes at...
with colored lights.
With colored lights, right? Green, amber, and red. So I want to speak to 3 points. One, from a local government perspective, what does... And primarily looking at the municipal model ordinance, what does it do from a local government perspective? Why it's important... from a local government perspective, then also why it's important in a broader sense. Lisa's mentioned several of these issues, but the model ordinance at the local level does some very significant things. It establishes public participation as a public good, as something that's essential for the general health, safety, and welfare of the community. That really doesn't exist anywhere else. So simply making that statement is an important contribution to local government. It sets standards, guidelines, principles of what good participation would be. And then it also addresses structural changes in local government. It provides for identifying a person, whether that's a participation specialist or an administrator or an officer, that at least would be equivalent. Most local governments designate a weed officer. So it would be good to have somebody designated with responsibility for public participation. Then it also sets up a number of issues, other structural changes, an advisory board made up of citizens, of members of the community, with the requirement that that board will do a multi-year plan and will do an annual report to the elected officials. So it starts to embed in the structure of local government a way to recognize and build and enable creativity and participation. So that's what it does at the local level, why it's important from a local government perspective. More and more the issues we deal with in local communities are wicked problems. You know, they're the problems where we don't know all the part of the question, and we certainly don't know all the parts of the answer. What we do know is that the way we address those is through collaboration. The way we address those from a local government perspective is building an effective working relationship with the members of the community. And that means that we need to have more effective ways of interacting with the public, of having the public comment and engage, define problems, help in identifying the solutions. And it's important from the model ordinance perspective is that it sets the ability for us to move from participation and engagement that's a function of champions, individual champions, to something that is sustained engagement because it's embedded in how the local government makes decisions, of how local government addresses participation. So that's a very important part. It's very important from a local government operation because we need innovation. We need to find more creative ways of addressing all of these issues in some way. And I think one of the points that I think John Nalbandian has made from KU, Rock Chalk Jayhawks, self-disclosure, right, is there's this growing gap between what we technically, looking at local government, what we technically can accomplish, okay, what we're able to do, and what, so there's a gap between that and the political efficacy of local officials' ability to act. So we have this growing gap, which is a real problem in local governments, and I think for local government. And I think with improved ways of how we do participation and engagement, it starts to build the capacity of local elected officials to have that consensus, have that support within their community to take action. And I think that's very important just in terms of the quality of service that's provided. My third point then has to do why this is important from a broader sense. As I look at local government, I think local government is at a watershed moment, one of those times that occur, you know, maybe every 30, 40, 50 years, where we're really looking at what is the appropriate, we're trying to reestablish what the appropriate role of government is in the system of governance, and governance really meaning local level, how we make decisions, which is a function of formal government, civil society, the private sector, nonprofit organizations, a whole constellation of stakeholders in that. And we're really looking at what is that role of government going to be in terms of what government can and should do, what others can do. And we're at that point of trying to figure out what that is. And it's very difficult, I think, from a local government level. A key part of that, with whatever that role is going to be, is reconstructing a more compelling vision of what the role of citizens, and by citizens I mean community members, of reconstructing a more compelling vision of what their role is in that whole process, in government and in governance. And I think a critical piece, and Matt made this point a couple of years ago in a report, that compelling vision for citizens is going to be something that ties to their talents, their interests, you know, their concerns. If we have to find some way to tie to that, and that means we have to find a more effective way to engage and participate. Finally, in terms of why this is important in a broader sense, it's probably cliche to say that we're, you know, engaged in the struggle for democracy. Maybe we're always engaged in that. From a local government perspective, I think one of the critical things in winning that struggle is what takes place in the local communities. People learn what it means to be an active citizen. They learn how to do that. They learn what it means, or they don't, I would argue, in the context of what they do in their local communities, of how they interact with their government, how they interact in all those, the workplaces, the schools, their neighborhood. They either learn how to do it or they don't in the context of the local communities. And I think this participation ordinance creates a structure where they learn how, it improves their ability to learn those very important skills. I was just thinking, I remember reading years ago, probably 30 years ago, the book by Benjamin Barber on strong democracy, and he makes the point that strong democracy needs great citizens, citizens that are effective at what they do. And I think the model state ordinance and the model local ordinance really start to set the stage for citizens to learn what it means to have a public life and become very effective, strong citizens in the context of their local government.
Thank you. I want to just say that I think it typifies my limited ability as an online engagement person that I A knew how to make a hashtag, but then B forgot to tell anybody about it. So thank you, Kevin, for remembering that part.
Oh, and there's some good stuff coming in here. So I thought I would just use a couple minutes for introduction, since I'm largely new to this community and Code for America as an organization is new to this space. Figure I'd just tell you a little bit about myself, why I'm up here, and why you should listen to anything I say or not. And then tell you about a couple of activities that I've been involved in for the last four or five years that really get to motivating people to participate. All right, so I'm a Virginian. I grew up in Virginia Beach. I went to Virginia Tech. I got a degree in history and an undergraduate degree in history and a master's degree in computer science. Spent a lot of time working in crazy virtual reality environments. Went to work for the federal government as a contractor in the defense space, co-founder of a company called Bridgeborne that has been in that space for about 12 years, and was reluctant to go in that area. And that's when I started getting exposed to a lot of the internal processes of the federal government and how things work, not so much in the participation space, but in IT procurement and how a lot of our technologies are built and how the government uses technology or fails to use technology effectively. And so it was about 2009 when the concept of Gov2O was really hitting the scene. The Gov2O summit came here to Washington, D.C., literally from a tweet sent out to Tim O'Reilly about a paper called Government Data and the Invisible Hand. I became involved in the organizing of the Gov2O summit. That's when I met Jennifer Palka, who is executive director, co-founder. Well, she's not currently the executive director. She's on hiatus. The founder of Code for America. She's now the deputy secretary for technology working for Todd Park. That's when she and I connected, and there was this conversation happening about Gov2O and participation at the federal space, and we were looking and having sidebar conversations and connecting with people all around the room about who's talking about this at the local level, because it's at the local level where really citizens touch government on a day-to-day basis in really practical ways. And, you know, when somebody's making a plan to come tear up your road, you tend to get really involved. Through tweeting, and be careful what you tweet because you might end up changing the world. We went to all these unconferences. We're having all of these bar camps, right? So if you're not familiar with an unconference, it's the idea that it's participant driven. It's not an agenda that's set by an organizing committee who hires or brings in speakers and sets the topics and the tracks. All of the topics in the agenda are set by the people who come to the event, and it's completely facilitated by moderators. So as organizers, you're facilitators, all right? So we went to all these unconferences in 2009, and I left one of them, two of them hosted by the Sunlight Foundation, who are definitely leaders in this space, called Transparency Camp West. And we had this big conversation about local government transparency. It brought pretty much everybody, 100 and some odd people from the event, to this one session on local government transparency that I had coaxed the former head of Octolabs in D.C., Washington, D.C., Dmitry Kaichev, to organize. And I was so inspired by that, I tweeted, I said, we should have a city camp. And Jen saw that and said, yeah, I think we should do that, and if you're serious, I'll help you. It was just an idea. It was just, we should have a city camp. I tweeted it out, you know, no big deal. That would be the end of that. Well, we decided, hey, maybe this is a good idea. So we spent the last part of 2009, November, December. One of the nice things about being a co-founder of a company is, you know, I get a little bit more leeway to take on some new projects. And my company was very supportive of me spending this time to help organize this event called City Camp. And we held it in January 23rd, 24th of 2010, and we really didn't have any idea of what to expect. All right. So what is CityCamp? CityCamp is an unconference for municipal innovation, and it's designed to bring together stakeholders from all across the government, from local community organizations, technologists, journalists, artists, regular, you know, ordinary citizens, to focus on the idea of innovating for their municipal governments and community service. And this idea of innovating for municipal government, you know, we weren't sure if anybody would be interested in that or take that seriously. And it turned out that a lot of people were interested in that. And people came, it was over 150 people came from all over the United States. They came from Canada. They came from the UK to spend 2.5 days at the University of Illinois Chicago Innovation Center with this idea of innovation for municipal government. And it was a really successful event beyond our wildest expectations. And when we left that, we thought, again, that would be the end of it. We did the camp. We followed other people who did events like that. We just copied what they did it ourselves, had a great event, and it was time to go back to work. I was going to go back to my company. Jen was going off to start Code for America. And this strange thing happened is that the hashtag, CityCamp, it kept being used on Twitter. People on the forum kept engaging in the dialogue, and people were asking, when are you going to have another CityCamp? When can you help me organize my CityCamp? How do I do a CityCamp? And we weren't really prepared for that. And at first, the answer was, no, we're not doing another one. No, I can't help you. I've been on loan for a long time to do this project for my company. I need to get back to work. But I wasn't really satisfied with that. And I was just frustrated and struggling. How can we not say no? How can we enable people to do this? And so a friend of mine, Luke Fretwell from GovFresh, who does a lot of media covering and blogging and video about this space of Gov2O, he came to me with this idea we should turn it into an open source brand. And so we spent a lot of nights. He's in California. I'm in Virginia Beach on Skype late night, working out what is this idea of an open source brand. So we came up with basic rules. We came up with 4 goals. We packaged it up on a website. We had logo and color scheme. We gave information on how to start a camp, and we stuck it online. And when we did that, it spread. It spread everywhere. I've lost count of how many city camps have happened, but they've happened in South America. They've happened in Europe, in Russia, in Asia, all over the United States. And everyone thinks that there's this organization called CityCamp and that I'm the executive director and the leader, and that's not true. It is a community of people who are passionate about this idea of using their technology skills to innovate for municipal government and their community organizations. So this thing is thriving. It's still going on. There's still an active community. You can check it out online. So then some time goes by, and Jen and I stay in touch. I was an advisor, just a volunteer advisor for Code for America, doing all of this stuff as a volunteer, which is, to me, super important. My professional aspirations are in business. I like to make things. I like technology. I like doing things. And when it comes to public participation and governance, I want to be a citizen. I want to be an active, engaged citizen. I want to be a volunteer. People ask me, when are you going to run for council? Not going to run for council. I want to be an active, engaged citizen because what you said, strong democracy needs strong citizens. So we can't just all like leave what we're doing to go become professionals in government. We need to be strong citizens where we are and the things that we do every day. So stay in touch with Jen, and she calls me up with this idea, says, hey, we're thinking about starting a volunteer movement for Code for America. Is there any way you could come help do that? And so went back to my co-founders and my board of directors and said, this is something that I really feel like I need to do. It's going to take a long time. It's going to take a couple of years to get this started. can I do it? And they said yes. And so we started the Code for America Brigade. All right, so if you don't know what Code for America is, you know, our mission statement is that it's a new kind of public service by the people, for the people, for the 21st century. Because that's what we're talking about here, is we're talking about there's lots of interest in public service, public participation, and it's not enabled for the 21st century. We talked back there about the Brown Law and how it's so old. It's been written in the 60s. And so we started this thing called the Code for America Brigade. And the Code for America Brigade is a national network of civic-minded technologists who use their skills to improve the way their governments and their community organizations use the web as a platform for participation, for innovation, and for engagement. So we're now a network. There are about 3,000 registered members on the website. There are even more people who connect through Meetup. And these are all volunteers all across the country. We're in 32 cities where we have what we call brigade captains. These are people who are leaders who have signed up for a year to lead in their city to try to make an effective difference in their city. So we're trying to evoke this idea of, you know, the volunteer fire brigade, the bucket brigade, you know, that type of metaphor. So that's how we came up with the brigade. And what we've been doing is, as you say, standing in front of council and advocating for open data laws. I can see now taking this ordinance and putting the call out to our members and say, you know, if you believe in public participation, then go to your council and make a statement on the record that they should enact this law. So anyway, that's me. That's how I got involved with this. That's the Code for America Brigade, and we're definitely glad to be in this conversation.
Awesome. Thank you. We have a microphone. You have 3 minutes each. We'll go on for 9 hours. We'll all fall asleep. No, it's difficult. You know, this is a meeting designed to launch a publication, and it's difficult, of course, in this kind of format to have the depth of the conversation I think we want to have now, and we would like to have about both what the publication is and also kind of the implications, how it could be used, adapted, the considerations that went into going to making it. All those things we'd love to talk about more. We'll try to do it over the next 45 minutes here as much as we can, and we promise not to fall asleep. And we do have a microphone, and we'd love to have both questions and also comments. And then also after that, we're going to carve out some time at the end, because I know there's some associations who've been part of this and who want to also help kind of continue this conversation. So I think I know ICMA, IFP2, NCDD, and I think there may be others that are represented here. And I want to make sure we have some time for people to say, here's what we think is the next piece of work that needs to be done on this, and here's what we're going to try to do, and please join us. So, but for right now, let's start with some comments and questions. And so maybe Jim right here up front.
What do you think of surveys as a vehicle for public participation? So recently, Silicon Valley has invested a fair bit of venture capital money. One company is Panera Education, which is trying to bring surveys to get parental feedback and teacher feedback and student feedback.
And I think the mic. Question is surveys as a method for participation.
And actually, a lot of, I know school systems best are using them, but they tend to degenerate into push polls and advocacy polls. It's very hard to fulfill the vision as a meaningful form of public participation. It's very appealing in the abstract. So I don't know what you think of the idea in general, but then also how could you implement that with new technology, it's much less expensive to do surveys, and you can do all sorts of amazing things, and you get less biased feedback too, because there's so much intimidation at a public school meeting when you're asking for participation or
So anyway, it's a whole bunch of issues. It solves the intimidation problem. You have a more representative survey. But on the hand, it's really easy to bias these things. And driving it all is the fact that the economics of doing surveys have just dramatically changed in the last few years. So why not take a bit better advantage of them?
Sure.
Silicon Valley certainly has that idea.
Yeah. Mike?
Well, I think surveys are an important part, and local governments use those. I think sometimes their technology is a little dated, and so it's more costly. I think a critical thing with the surveys, though, is recognizing whether it's a survey or some other online approach, how you integrate that with the face-to-face discussion. I think sometimes there's a temptation just to rely on one mode. But surveys, I think, are a very important way of having some way of statistically knowing what's going on and identifying some of the issues and concerns.
Another example, the Palo Alto, or no, Menlo Park, I think, used surveys as part of a combined online and in-person approach to participatory budgeting, I believe. And what they did was they were not simply collecting opinions, are you satisfied, are you unsatisfied? They were collecting information about, okay, we got this much money, how would you distribute it? And then you can actually give a picture of what the budget would look like from the public.
Yeah, I guess I would say surveys are terrific. And they have their own, like so many other participation methods, they have their own strengths and weaknesses. And I guess a weakness when you're thinking about some of the wicked problems that local governments face is the fact that in a survey you don't get those people talking to each other. You know, so you never create kind of or it's harder to create the kind of consensus you might want to actually support, to have some kind of broadly supported policy. And I think part of the hope for this ordinance and this whole idea here is to create that kind of conversation about the long-term engagement plan, like Mike was talking about. You know, because so often what happens is some kind of local leader or somebody says, yeah, we need to get participation in X, and then they pick one single thing. Let's have a survey, or let's just have a dialogue, or let's just have this big meeting. You know, where in most cases what they really need is some combination of them because they all have their different strengths and weaknesses. And so if you have a plan and you're not kind of lurching from one method, one app, one format to the next, if you have some kind of, you know, structured plan for how you do engagement and for what kind of purposes and what situations, then I think it's more likely you get that kind of good mix as opposed to one single thing which may not meet the needs.
Some of the concerns about the dialogue, there are technological and process fix for that. If you use a survey tool that allows comments or that's attached, that creates an email form so people can then talk to each other afterwards, that could potentially be fixed through technology pretty easily.
That's true. Absolutely.
But,
yes. Okay, yes. And maybe go to Charlie in the back, Nick.
Thank you.
And say who you are. Sorry.
I'm Charlie Wisoff. I'm a research assistant with the Kettering Foundation, who researches much of this type of thing. I have two questions about things that were mentioned during the presentations, specific choices you made, and you can address either or if you would like. You mentioned that you were not focusing on federal law, and I was wondering why exactly that choice was made, considering there have been federal laws that have mandated participation. I'm thinking specifically of the Equal Opportunity Act and the maximum feasible participation requirement. And then the second question, which is somewhat related, is about the choice not to mandate it, but to make it a possibility and open up rather than providing money or saying you should do it like this?
Two little questions.
So you mandate something to elected officials at the local government level and you don't fund it, they go crazy. It won't go anywhere. And their elected state officials in the state legislature won't pass it. So we don't really have a choice about mandates politically. With respect to maximum feasible participation, I think Moynihan wrote a book on its failure as an approach. It was repealed because it was an unfunded mandate. Many federal grant programs don't allow states to spend the money that they're getting on public participation. This is an unresolved problem. As for why we started at the local level, it seemed at that time that there was critical mass among the various membership organizations that were part of the team to attack the problem there. There was a working group that grew out of Strengthening Our Nation's Democracy, which was a conference 2008, and then again 2010?
Yeah, several months.
that drafted a potential executive order along similar lines, and although it wasn't used, some of the thinking that went into it became part of President Obama's memorandum on open and transparent government, the executive memorandum that was signed his first full day in office in 2009. So it became absorbed into the open government initiative and directive. We do need a federal statute, and we're still working.
Go ahead. David Grant, Common Lot Productions. All well and good, but what about going to not just upstream, but to the source? I noticed Lisa's background in ancient Greek and Matt's connection with the New Democracy Foundation in Australia. I, like Kevin, will not put myself and never will put myself on the auction block of electoral campaigning. How about a two-legged democracy, as in the first democracy in ancient Greece, which is to say the legislative body itself be, as James Madison said, an exact transcript of the population at large. Then all of this is no longer is moot. If you have a legislature which is truly representative of all the people, which is including those of us who will not stand for election, those of us who are not have the time and money to be volunteering for public participation, as you're suggesting, but rather are actually in that policy-making body, using voting in the policy-making body, but not it as the legislature itself, that would be like the jury system, chosen at random, at lot, by lot, through sortition. That seems to me going to the source.
Kevin, anybody?
For a question.
Well, I think the kind of this, like this discussion about the surveys, I think representative sample models are useful as a part of the picture and maybe more useful in certain settings and certain issues than others. I don't think they're ever the whole picture. You know, that there's just not the popular support, you know, if you're only working with this, however meticulously crafted this public is, if you're only working with this very mini public and there's not an opportunity for other people to participate, then it doesn't usually have the political weight, you know. However, if you have other ways that are easier, you mentioned how difficult it is for people to participate. I think part of the question here is how do we make it easier and more gratifying for people to participate? And if you have that broader base of engagement, then I think there's more support, more possibility for random sample, other kinds of, sortition, other kinds of approaches.
Okay, so this is...
Now you're ready? Is
this right? So this makes it's you talked about making it easier, and actually I think about incentives, right? So how do we incentivize people to participate more? So my biggest barrier to entry is not so much the law, but it's apathy. And so what we're trying to do is motivate people to participate where they already can. Now, there are a ton of barriers to that. I don't want to go to a basement room for a meeting on a Tuesday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, halfway across town, in order to participate. Right, so I should be able to participate online in some way. And there are legal barriers to that. When you talk about, can more than one city councilor comment on it and have it not be like a public meeting all of a sudden? So I don't know if we're going to be able to change the way our legislature is made up, but I would be a lot happier if we could incentivize and motivate for people to participate where they already have that ability to do so and they're just not.
Hmm. Just one last comment. There are some nascent models that would begin to touch on what you're talking about. California has a grand jury system, for example, where people are selected not to be in a courtroom, but to actually look at a policy problem in a municipality and investigate and report out. There are kinds of consensus councils that have been used in Australia, that are embedded in Denmark, where you pick a random sample of the electorate and they deliberate on a policy issue and issue a report that then shapes policy in the legislature. So there's the beginning of this, but nothing as grand as a bigger direct democracy.
Well, Oregon Citizens Initiative Review is another example. Go ahead.
Thank you. Actually, we may have a twofer question because I think Abby also had a question. I'm Sydney Heimbrop, Sydney Heimbrock. I'm with the Office of Personnel Management, and I actually was hoping you could comment. You've tended to focus on the legislative policymaking process, and I was hoping you could comment on the executive policy and program design process and how to enable improved participation in that, because one of the things we're trying to do is expand the universe of people that executive branch program leadership and managers have access to as they do this critical step of actually designing how policies will be implemented, which is, of course, how citizens experience it.
Mm. I'll decline.
Okay.
Thank you.
She gives you her 3 minutes.
In all fairness.
You'll go ahead.
Yeah, so the draft state statute is intended to encompass both executive branch agencies and local government. Because of the variation across the states, it's sort of open-ended because not all Freedom of Information Acts or Government in the Sunshine Acts are written in the same way. And some may diverge as opposed to treating the state executive branch agencies and the local government entity in the same way. But the notion is, in the model state statute, that there would be a mandate for executive branch agencies. They would be given the same definition, the same open door, a mandate to develop a policy and a mandate to appoint a public participation specialist and then cover politically or from litigation by committing the choice of process to that agency's discretion. So we have been talking mostly about local government level, but the draft also covers executive branch agencies at the state government level.
Hi, I'm Fred Altman. I'm retired. I got a couple of questions. The first is really naive. The ordinance sounds like Godmother and Apple Pie, and everybody should be for it. Where's the pushback? What resistance are you running into? And the second is, at Brookings, there's a Metropolitan Studies group, and they've come out with a book, Metropolitan Revolution, which indicates much of the power is now moving towards the cities, and I would think what you're talking about would really be relevant for that program. Are you aware of it, and do you have any comments?
You want to talk about our pushbacks?
Well, I think one of the pushbacks at the local level is that I would say the dominant view of most local administrators and managers is public participation is a giant pain in the butt. And when you do it, there are four things that can happen and three of them are bad. You know, that type of notion because of their experiences.
Yeah.
So I think one of the pushbacks is from a local government perspective, from an executive or the CEO's perspective, there's a cost of doing this. There are all sorts of potential negatives in doing this. So there's going to be at least inertia, if not resistance, to taking on yet another task in this world of declining revenues and growing demand. So the biggest pushback, quite frankly, I think will come from local managers that are already juggling a dozen things and say, okay, now you want me to do this too, type of thing. That's why I think, from my perspective, saying that this is a public good, that participation is not just incidental to the street project and the budget and the parks and all that. It's not just incidental, but it is an essential good for the welfare of the community, kind of reframes how managers can think about it.
Yeah, I think a weakness of this ordinance and the act, I mean, and probably a necessary weakness, is that it continues to treat participation as a government responsibility. And that's, I think, an assumption we have to get beyond, that you know, participation is a public value. It needs to be supported by a range of organizations in the community. You've got to be, if you're creating a plan, and we're hoping that this model ordinance, if nothing else, creates that conversation among these different kinds of leaders, public, nonprofit, private sector, you know, faith community, about participation. What kind of participation do we want? And then after that, how are we all going to support it from our various organizations and perches? And then after that, what should our law be? or what's our policy to you, or who's going to be the specialist or whatever.
Yeah.
That's because otherwise it's true. You're dealing with, you're up against a level of frustration and kind of shell shock among local officials. I mean, if you think that the levels of public trust in public officials are low, start interviewing public officials about their trust for their constituents. And believe me, it's even lower. And you can understand why. I mean, people are subjected to an endless series of terrible formats for participation in which people yell at them. So it's understandable that this is, in fact, not an intellectual issue for local government. It's an emotional issue. And you have to kind of get beyond that and, in many cases, exemplify what good participation could look like before people will begin to say, all right, I'm going to no longer treat this as kind of something I have to do, you know, in order to just kind of satisfy the law. This is something that I could actually get something out of. And at least I can get people not to yell at me anymore. Kevin, did you want to add it?
Well, I mean, this is something that I struggle to understand because, you know, they're only going to get more of the bad with the status quo.
Right.
And so we could present them options. The option is to have no public participation. That will go nowhere, right? That's not a democracy. And so why hold on to this old system that you hate when we're offering, okay, let's bring more people into the process? The best way that I can deal with a troll on a forum is to bring them into a public forum, bring them into a public space and let them participate. And the other thing is that, like, you know, this, I hate that notion of us and them when it comes, there's no such thing called the government, right? It's we the people, right? So it's ours. And so we need to make it more positive experience, invite, you know, just sort of normal, everyday, rational people and make it easy for them, make it fun for them even. Otherwise, you're just going to get more of the status quo where you have nothing but trolls. and we need to fix that.
Good.
Just want to be responsive to the point about the book, which I would love to see, and honestly, I confess, I haven't read. There has been a recent survey commissioned by the Irvine Foundation in California that went out both to public officials about public engagement and also went out to all the civic leaders who are not in government, two different versions of it. It's available, downloadable online. Fascinating about people's experiences. There's also the Knight Foundation has been funding this notion of building platforms for collaboration across nonprofits, private sector, the government, at the local government level. We've been talking mostly about the individual participant, and although we've used the word citizen, we mean to include residents, whether or not they have citizenship. But to address this power shift, you really need more collaborative governance that includes the residents, the citizens, and these other organized entities on some sort of a platform.
Hi, I'm Ashley Trim. I'm with the Davenport Institute at Pepperdine, and we worked on that Irvine Foundation survey.
Awesome.
And one of the things that I was thinking about this when the question came earlier about why not mandate, and I think that's one of the things is you do have a lot of local governments that don't necessarily have the trust in residents, but who are open to trying things. One of the things that survey found is that local officials are interested in increasing public participation, but not necessarily for every issue. Sure. And so I think taking down that first barrier and seeing, okay, so for the issues that we realize the 3 minutes at a microphone is really not working, how can we open that door? And one of the ways that I was sort of bringing people into the room, my question sort of as a follow-up on that is, as you're moving into the online area and having more online engagement on the one hand and then trying to connect that with face-to-face interaction and meetings, and you're drawing probably two very different audiences into the city hall versus the online, are there ways, and this might be moving ahead to sort of next steps, so sorry if I'm getting ahead of us, but are there ways of integrating those comments so that the people who are engaging online and the people who are coming to the face-to-face are engaging with each other, as well as just both presenting their viewpoints to the governing officials?
Go ahead.
Well, I think a critical thing about the local ordinance, the short answer is no. I don't know that there's a clear, here's the cookbook approach to it. I think, although there are ways that it works, but I think the critical thing is allowing local governments the ability to move in that direction and to figure it out, as opposed to feeling like they're stopped, that the law is keeping them from doing that.
I think one of our principles is that the potential of the combination of online and face-to-face, which I think all of us who are practitioners are really interested in, the problem has been, for a variety of reasons, that those two types of innovation have mostly gone kind of developed in along separate paths. And so I think as a field, this is a big question that Sandy and IEP, a lot of us who work in this are trying to kind of figure out, I know you are as well, of kind of how do you create more models that include the best of both. And I think there's some emerging, and as part of this thing that Carolyn and I have been involved in, the National Dialogue on Mental Health, we're hatching a whole new one, which is for text-supported dialogue for among young people. But that's a tremendous source of possibility. I also want to say that just the earlier part of your comment, I think that it's true that there is an appetite for this. And in fact, when Bill Barnes from NLC back there, I did a survey a couple years ago of local officials about public engagement. One of the questions asked was, what are the biggest barriers to you doing this or doing more public participation? And we were, I think, I was expecting the answer, cost or at least, you know, staff time to be the top answer. And it was like sixth. I mean, it was down near the bottom. And the thing that was at the top was training. Lack of training, lack of understanding of what the models are, what the possibilities are, and how we actually use them. So. Do you want to go? Just, then we'll go to Carolyn.
Just one last thing. There's a great book out of MIT Press in 2012 on connected democracy that looks at combining online and in-person engagement and talks about the importance of authentic democratic intention and also evaluation and research built into the design. And this is just a plug for anyone in the room in a position to fund that work. We need it.
We'll be passing the hat.
Carolyn Lukens-Meyer, the National Institute for Civil Discourse. First of all, congratulations. I know how much work has gone into this, and this is a real milestone. Just something that's occurred to me, given just who you are as a panel, as a possible, very definable project as a next step that could both mean something to a community and be researched. Mike is a city official who's understood the importance of this forever. We all agree that an empowered citizenry is what we want. You have all spoken about most of the face-to-face participation innovation has kind of grown up separately from the online, which is mostly focused on transparency and improved services, whereas the other side is a lot focused on decision-making on policy and budgets. Mm. What a fantastic thing to do. Find one, two, three communities that adopt the piece of legislation, has a couple of enlightened public officials who know how to use it, and connect it to some communities where you have brigades that are already operating, so that we actually could be in a community where the public entity calls for this, has some history relative to face-to-face participation, brings in a whole different layer of it with citizens who want to connect that way. And that, I think, is what would take forward the kind of question about how do we actually end up with an empowered citizenry that crosses generations, that crosses the digital divide, and deals not just with transparency and services or not just with policy and budget decisions, but really could be a holistic approach?
Terrific. And let me just partly because I want to make sure we get some things in. That's a terrific idea for a way to move forward with this. I know there's some others, and I know there's some organizations or associations in the room that have interests in carrying this forward. So I just want to kind of put an opening for Sandy, and I know Doug. Where'd he go? There he is. There's Doug. And I know Mike on behalf of ICMA to say a little bit more about the interests of your associations in kind of going forward. Those kinds of ideas or other ways one could kind of take this work forward. And so we need a mic. Either of you want to talk or...
Hi, Doug Sarno. I'm here representing IEP2. And first of all, I just want to say, great. We fully support everything you're doing. I love the principle-centered nature of the governance piece you're putting together, because that's really what's missing for a lot of this. I mean, you all mentioned it, and we've been fighting this for years in terms of what's the real intent? Are we just trying to check a box and move along, or are we really trying to engage people in substantive, you know, decision making? Our focus is on process. It's I think Mike hit the nail on the head. This is all about good governance. It's all about good decision making. how do we build the right processes? How do we pull the tools and the technology into those things, not make them replacements for a good process, but build into process how that works? And so we stand ready to support this process in any way you want. We'd like to bring to bear our, we got resources all over the country, strong practitioners all over the country that would be love to volunteer and get engaged and get involved. So whatever's next, we'd like to be part of it. We'd love to support it.
Awesome.
Okay, I'll go next. I'm Sandy Heyerbacher with NCDD, which is the National Coalition for Dialogue and Deliberation. And we represent a couple thousand people, mostly in the U.S., who are innovators in this kind of space. So lots of facilitators. And these three of you four are members of NCDD, so we'll have to get you afterwards.
Chemist check is your name.
But I guess I wanted to say that, and we're part of the working group, and really proud to be part of it, super supportive of it, and excited about what is possible. I guess I just wanted to say that we represent a community of professionals who are underutilized by government, and this is an opportunity to make that change. I'm sorry, that just came into my head at that moment. So that was terrible. So they work outside of government and despite government, you know, and we need to have them work in collaboration with government. Some of our members have actually worked with local government to change their policies already. So one of the things we'd like to do is see who has done that, you know, Portland's public engagement policies and Austin's and others, and how does this blend in with what innovations have been happening in those communities. But I'm ready to really push this with our members and see lots of people use it. And I also would like to just make sure that it rolls out in a way that is energizing and motivates public officials to embrace public participation. And I think it's great that there's no mandate. This is a set of principles and set ordinances that you have to pass. It's not about that. It's about having a conversation in your community to figure out what's best for your town or your city. So, yeah, kudos. I'm really excited. And that's it for me.
Here from Mike, and then back to Chris, maybe in the back.
Well, just very briefly, for ICMA, the City County Management Association, just launched a fourth area of leading practice. They established a Center for Management Strategies here a couple of years ago. A former manager, Cheryl Hilbert, is director of that, and just launched the civic engagement component of that here officially, really, with their conference. They've identified a number of service providers, one of which is IAP2, and really looking at the issue of how to work with local managers to build that structure, you know, how to find different ways from the manager's perspective and the charges they have. How do they build that participation in there? So that's just really rolling out now with ICMA. And one of the challenges will be, you know, with its 9,000, 10,000 members, of, to a certain extent, people that are trained to be problem solvers, and you solve your problems by controlling the problem, and move away from controlling the outcomes to trusting the process. And I think that's where it's going to be very critical to draw on practitioners, you know, NCDD and IAP2, and get them in relationships with local managers.
There in the back. Sorry. and then you. Sorry.
Hi, I'm Chris Berendis with Netlist, and I've also recently done some work with America Speaks, which I'll touch on. To me, this is a lot like talking about exercise. We know we should do it, and we're all here exercise enthusiasts, right? But there are two things about that. One is there are different kinds of exercise, there are different kinds of participation, different methods, processes, different outcomes. And two, you still need incentives. So 14 years ago, after having been in shape but not really much, I started running three times a week because I wanted to keep up with my nephew when I was skiing. Okay, that was a real tangible thing that got me off my duff. Recently, I started yoga, which is very different. My running doesn't help me at all because I can't bend anymore. Okay, so going now to the public good and what this has to do with public participation and motivation as well. Recently, working with America Speaks, I had a chance to talk to some of their former clients, design firms that have retained them for participation work. informal conversation that essentially went like this. Gosh, you guys, you're happy with us? You dropped a lot of money on us. What'd you get? And in one case, the answer was, well, we were researching various design alternatives for a small area plan. We had four design tracks we were pursuing. Thanks to the participation process, we could drop two of them, saving $150,000 and a month and a half of design time. Okay, that's fun. Another one was a similar kind of thing where a public, actually PR person, approached the firm and said, we want to work more with you because we find when we use you or similar processes to build larger projects, they'd work with universities and so forth, we find that the project goes better after it's built because we have more community goodwill. Not quite as tangible. But my question to you with this as background is, what kinds of concrete incentives do you see for cities, localities, to actually do this stuff? In other words, what is it, the counterpart of my being able to out-ski my nephew that really motivates people?
Awesome. One thing I think that's very important in all of this is that when the ordinary person, the everyday person participates, they see some connection from that and the outcome. It doesn't have to be exactly the decision they want, but they have to see that connection. Same way with exercise. I mean, when you run three times a week or you exercise, you see some change. You see some result. I think in the participation part with local government, people that are very reluctant to participate because they've been there before, talked, and nothing's happened, they want to get some sense that their time spent is having an outcome. Real core to the principles, the values I think we see in participation. And that's the challenge I think the local government has, is how do you work with the members of the community so they're working on something they really care about and they see some impact, they see some type of action. That'd be a big one, but they have to see some type of change that took place. And that, to me, is probably the bottom line for local government being more effective in this.
And in the end, you need to document it. Oh, yeah. So the problem is we don't have funding for public engagement, let alone research and documentation of what happens as a result of public engagement. I mean, it's an under-researched area. And human nature and the training of the people commissioning these processes is such that they need that kind of documentation for political cover. I mean, my background, I first got into empirical work in collaboration with the United States Postal Service, which was adopting a mediation program for the first time for employment disputes. And it started in 94. In 97, we're presenting the first pilot data to the Postmaster General and the Management Committee. They're all MBAs. And what they want is numbers, and we had some numbers. And the Postmaster General, Marvin Runyon, at the end of the meeting said, sounds like a good program, which was in 25 cities at that point. Think we should go national. I want a plan on my desk by Monday. But it was because there was some tangible, objective evidence that they could use. And I don't know how we get people to fund this.
Well, we do have some numbers. I mean, it's been a weakness, but we have over time accumulated some. And even though I'm actually not a researcher, I just play one on TV, I did a couple of years ago, or last year, I went through a whole bunch of different evaluations of public engagement processes and picked out some numbers. And so, as a result of participation in this project, 76% of the people contacted their member of Congress, or they, 25% more action ideas or people's sense of empowerment, So I just kind of picked out numbers. It wasn't that hard to kind of come up with a bunch of numbers from the small minority of efforts which actually have this level of research. But as it became a fairly compelling picture when I, it's actually on the DDC site if you want. It's called Deliberation by the Numbers. But that more of that kind of cross, taking more advantage of the research we do have and the numbers we do have, because I think probably is a good idea.
But also building it in at the place where the engagement
is
happening.
Yes, that's true. That's true. She's been waiting very patiently right here. Oh, I'm sorry.
You're next. on tangible outcomes, I suspect that there might be many thousands of tangible outcomes that when you get down to it are the result of better public participation. So I want there to be real-time mobile bus app in Hampton Roads because I know Hampton Roads Transit has that information. So I need a participation process to enact that. I want there to be to be easier for small businesses to do to contract with the government. So there's this outcome that I'm after, for which having greater public participation. I want to be involved in how this street that runs through my neighborhood is designed. You know, is there going to be a bike lane? So there are thousands of tangible outcomes I think that are the result of better participation.
Thank you. My name is Sandhya Venugopal, and I'm a surgeon scientist, but looking on a sabbatical this year and looking to transition into health policy and public engagement. Health policy and public engagement. So my question is from a healthcare perspective. The people whose voice most need to be heard, but who don't even know that they actually have a voice, do you have any experience or any suggestions on how to implement their engagement? That's the best way to capture a broader population base, and also in terms of incentivization, not just them, but also the public officials. Can there be crowdsourced funding or venture capital or something used? Maybe you come for half an hour face-to-face, you'll get a $20 gift card from Safeway or something like that. Mm-hmm. That might be more of an incentive for a poor person to participate in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I just wonder.
I think, first of all, to begin with the notion, you have to actively seek out, you have to actively recruit people to participate. And there are ways that have worked to incentivize that. But many times there's the tendency, here's a meeting, come if you want. And it pays no attention to whether people have access, whether they need childcare, whether they're working the night shift, whatever. So I think when you do it at the local level, you really have to look at people that typically don't participate. Why don't they? And then actively seek those out. Incentives, it may be online, it may be face-to-face, it may be whatever. But I think many times government doesn't do that. We just, here's the meeting, here's the time, anybody can come. Oh, didn't show up. Okay, guess they don't care.
You have to go where people are.
Right.
You have to go where they are.
Maybe the biggest incentive, I think, is people like to have fun. People like to see each other, meet friends, eat food, enjoy music. And we, in this country in particular, have kind of pulled all the political stuff. All the political life has to happen way over here, and community life only happens over here. And there's really actually a lot of, we go more into this, but people really want more community life as well. People want more community connection. And when you talk about health, that's a really interesting kind of area of research I didn't really know much about until recently, but it is in fact true that when it comes to measures of health, social connectedness is incredibly important, as I'm sure you know. That I didn't realize that apparently the top three causes of premature death, number three is obesity, number two is smoking, number one is loneliness. There's we need to be thinking about participation and talking about participation in these more holistic ways, and the other kinds of, talk about numbers and impacts, those types of goals and things that one can accomplish, in addition to, yes, I was able to affect the fact that there's a new bike lane, those kinds of things. And so, which is a tall order, because it's a really huge scale here. But once you if we can advocate more on those terms and go where people are and create these settings that are both community life and political life, then you can have a much broader base of people, diversity of people involved, and the benefits, of course, will also be greater.
And crowdsourced funding, can we use that? Is there a law for or against it?
Crowdsourced funding. I'm looking at you, Kevin.
Well, my answer is yes. I heard her say, is there a law why you can't? And so I may be operating in a space of blissful ignorance here, but, my answer to those questions is yes, and just do it, right? So we tend to go out and do things, and then we run into barriers. We either try to find a way around them or we take them down. But, do it, definitely. Give it a try. Innovate.
Now, from the legal standpoint, it's probably easier to have the donations go into the community foundation than it is to have them go into government because of this question of bribe versus donation. But the other piece of bringing people in is we typically talk about separation between church and state, but faith-based communities have been working in California with local government in the arena of public engagement, and that's a good place to find people in their own community.
Absolutely. Right there in the middle. Trying to figure out whose hands have been up the longest. I'm not sure I could keep track.
Hello, hi. I'm Alfarina. I'm actually from Singapore, so I've traveled half across the world to come here.
Wow.
Really. And one of the real reasons why I was here is because there is a Singapore Management University who's going to collaborate with Brookings Institute to form a Masters of Tripartite. And I was so excited because I'm coming from a citizen's perspective. I own a company where we help organizations create meaningful impact. And what I'm curious about at the moment is that I'm from the world where the government's throwing money, literally, for active participation. And we've got lots of grants, we've got lots of funding, lots of incentives. Good. A lot of times people are interested, but they don't know how to access these funds. And I'm also noticing a good problem to have where we have lots of mini, I guess, associations or drives or visions, but not one consolidated effort to really publicize what all of these mini groups are doing. Yeah. So then it's like a lot of people doing the same thing sometimes. So my question is there a technological framework to actually help that right from the beginning? And I'm seeing Singapore as starting from the beginning at the point in time. That's one question. The second question as well is, because of all of this funding and because I'm just one of those crazy people who wants to change the world, I'm also very interested in getting connected to or know more about associations in the United States who are already doing this as part of their work in the association organization. So thank you.
There was a city camp in Singapore, actually, last year. So there might be a community of people that you can connect to. You know, in my experience, when you have lots of people around the country doing the same thing and you have this overlap, it's not so much a technological solution to that as an organizational one. So when we started the brigades, there were civic innovation labs all over the country. There were, you know, what we call civic hackers, so civic-minded technologists who like to work around the process to solve things. There were groups all over the country doing that, and it was when we provided an organization through Code for America that connected them all together. That's when the real change and the real leveling up happened. It wasn't really so much a technological solution. It was, hey, we're gonna stand on the mountain and we're gonna hold up the light and bring everybody, and we told them, you know, celebrate what your local identity. You don't need to change who you are in order to be a part of this network. We want to recognize the thing that you're doing where you live and your contribution. So, you know, be inclusive, put up a big tent, whatever metaphor you want to use, but allow all those groups to come together through one maybe meta organization. That's how the brigade's been successful in the United States and now internationally.
And it's a combination then of the face to face and the online networking.
Absolutely.
But I think another thing that's intriguing about this whole question is mapping. You know, in terms of online tools, I mean, the fact that we have this capacity now through these cell phones with GPS stuff built into them. You know, the first set of this kind of mapping tools or things like C-Click-Fix would allow people to kind of identify potholes or graffiti, and it was a way of kind of funneling complaints to the right part of city government. Then the next generation, things like Public Stuff, I guess, and other groups like that, allows people to find other problem solvers. You know, who else wants to help clean up the vacant lot of the corner of 6th and Main, you know? And then I think there's a level above that where you may be able to kind of allow people to kind of stake their claim on particular kinds of projects, issues, things that they're doing that they want help with, that may be beyond just the simple kind of problem-solving, kind of street cleanup kind of deal. So I think there's a lot of potential there for cities to kind of explore this, to use those kinds of online tools that are pretty accessible now that allow people to do a bunch of things and really connect spatially with each other and the problems and the challenges they see in their communities. One other quick thing. Coming from across the world, I mean, the other thing I think it's important for Americans to know is that there's an enormous amount of work that's happening in other countries, particularly in the global south, on these issues. And in fact, we may well be behind the curve. We think of ourselves as the kind of the democratic, you know, ideal somehow. But in fact, I think Brazil and India, to name two, are ahead of us when it comes to democratic innovation, not just participatory budgeting, but other kinds of things as well. And so, especially with the legal and infrastructure, I mean, just your glimpse of Singapore, maybe with just a little glimpse of, I think, a much more supportive infrastructure, sounds like, than what we have here. So we've got a lot to learn from other countries. We've only got time for like one or two more, but I'm not sure who's had their hand up the longest. Maybe you in the back? Okay. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Aiden Van Oppen, and I'm with the White House Council on Strong Cities, Strong Communities. So we work in distressed cities around the country. So these are places where the biggest thing on the municipality's mind is saving money and the fact that they're in serious financial distress and in often cases in real sort of crisis mode. So in those cities, I feel like it's all that much more important to have really meaningful public participation processes and especially sort of inclusive participation processes. But how do you... Making the argument is really hard. These aren't cities where there's necessarily money on the table to hire somebody in City Hall to carry out this kind of work. So making the argument around money that's saved through these processes and sort of it's that much more efficient to engage the community because you're going to have solutions that make more sense for the community. You're not as likely to waste money on things that are completely like sort of devoid of, devoid isn't really the right word, but that are disconnected from the realities on the ground, especially with real neighborhood-based sorts of interventions. So in terms of the incentives for cities to do this type of thing, is there work that's been done to document that specifically, to show that, for example, if you're trying to address public safety in a certain community, it makes a lot more sense to have the community members tell you where they need more streetlights or where they need, what the actual intervention should look like, which parks are actually the most dangerous, and how that should be addressed. So anyways, I'm just wondering if that's been documented either globally or in the U.S. We're trying to make this argument to the cities where we work, but it's hard unless we can really make it in that kind of financial savings type of light.
Yep. Talk to Denise Ross in New Orleans about blight status. All right, so, I mean, there's a perfect example of a city you're talking about. City of New Orleans has lots of blighted properties. It was a data set owned by the sheriff and a responsibility owned by the sheriff's department, just as because they were considered public safety issues. And they opened that up. There's a fellowship team that went down there and they worked for Denise on this project. And they opened that up. They made that data more accessible. They made it more attractive even. It was available through smartphones. You can start making comments on it. And they invited the public to get engaged in this conversation on blighted properties. What do we do with our blighted properties? So if you want to look for stories and examples and people to talk to, that's a good one. Denise Ross in New Orleans.
Yeah, and another place to look is the work of Arkan Fung, who's at the Kennedy School at Harvard and has done extensive work on community policing in Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a need for more and more of this. I already spend most of my waking hours writing stuff like that, so I'm not sure how much more I can. But yes, I mean, we need more of this. And part of it is not simply there's the argument about savings on government services, you know, or because of policies that are better supported, or because information gathered from the community helps to make the policy smarter. There's also the argument about contributions the community can make. And I think we're seeing more and more of that, and certainly in the online realm. I mean, you mentioned kind of like the bus schedule app in Hampton. You know, in my experience, from what I can tell, a whole lot of the bus schedule apps that are springing up in every city all over the country are being done by people outside government. you know, all kinds of people who have, at least a little bit of technological skill doing these things that are, allow people to better able access government services, better able to give improvements, those kinds of things. So there's lots of the kind of the tech-related kinds of contributions that people are making, and also the good old-fashioned, ways in which people contribute to problem solving. Pete Peterson from Ashley Trim's organization has written a great one about Hawaii. But there's a lot of inspiring examples like that which illustrate not only why this is beneficial as far as government services and savings in that sense, but also contributions that people can make.
How about self-interest for public officials getting reelected?
Engage more of your... Sure. That's very interesting. Yes. Yes. What was it? Brazilian public officials who have done participatory budgeting are 30% more likely to be reelected than their kind of, there's some interesting data about these kinds of things on that sense. Again, not enough, but interesting data on that sense as well. When are you kicking us out, Daryl? can we take another couple or one more? All right. Right here. You've been waiting patiently.
Hello, I'm Stephen Cull from the Program for Public Consultation and Voice of the People. We've developed a method we call policymaking simulations where we give people we try to put people in the shoes of the policymaker. They get a briefing, they hear pro and con arguments, and we work with congressional staffers to participate in developing that so that everybody's really satisfied, all sides are heard, that it's subjective, that so both sides of the aisle get to weigh in. And then we do these with a representative sample so that people get to really hear, but with a national sample. And we're working now to try to actually create legislation to create a National Academy for Public Consultation that will then have a standing panel called the Citizen Cabinet with a few hundred in every congressional district. And we've been trying to sell this idea on the Hill, and it's interesting that we've had about 60 meetings on the Hill, and we've had a very positive response, invariably positive. And the thing that we find that they really like is the idea that the people, they get so much input that they find very raw. And very it's like, give me this, I want that, don't do this, and it all doesn't add up. Cut the deficit, don't raise taxes, don't cut spending, and it's like, what do you do with that, right? So the idea that people would be inside the policymaker's shoes and would have to create a budget, would have to deal with trade-offs, have to take into account the pro and con arguments so that they're dealing with scored options along the way. That they find really appealing. And then they like the idea that if people come at them with that kind of raw opinion, they go, well, go do this process, where go through the simulation, get yourself in my shoes, and then get back to me. They love that idea, and that they would also be able to hear from their constituents, a representative sample of their constituents in that way. So, there we are, Congress moves really slowly, but their legislation has been written and things are moving along. And so it just seemed to me, I was really struck by the feeling that, a lot of policymakers don't like the idea of public engagement because of that rawness, but if you let them participate in developing the structure, so they get to their experience gets on the table as well, then they have a really different response.
That's right. Yeah, I think having public officials, public employees, be part of the conversations rather than separate from them and waiting for the results, absolutely, for all the reasons you mentioned, and the emotional reason, because they get something out of giving people a chance to walk, as you say, walk a mile in their shoes. And there's something that's very gratifying and compelling to them, and more so, in my experience, than the numbers you might give them, is that chances to help people realize what the job that they do, the tough decisions they get faced with, all those kinds of things. So I know we're wrapping up here. Did you have any final? Thanks, everybody. Obviously, this conversation will continue, and thank you for being here today.